come. First, let me tell you about the idea of this block lectures about interpretation of quantum mechanics. So actually, I was, together with Francesca Sauli, for some years, organizing a seminar about something like new developments of quantum mechanics, interpretation of quantum mechanics, so to say something similar. It was rather successful. For over 5 years we did it. And then I decided, since I have each year I have to organize one lecture here in Frankfurt, I decided to merge this seminar into one lecture. And I completely underestimated how that this is not easy. A seminar is, of course, easier to organize than a lecture because the students do the job, at least big part of the job, because they have to do the presentations. And of course, I mean, there is a lot of discussions and so on. A lecture is a bit different because one needs an organic preparation of materials and so on. This is definitely more difficult. So it took me definitely more work than what I originally thought. But at the same time, it was very good since I didn't do it for 3 years, since I basically left from Frankfurt. It was good to take all these papers out and also look what it is new, because in the last 3 years there were some rather interesting developments in this topic. So if we go back, there was already the shut up and calculate. This was after the debate between let's say Einstein and Bohr. Definitely a good advice that worked for many, many years. So just do the calculations, calculate the probabilities, this is what we can get, and so on. The situation, I would say, changed gradually. So we had some examples of people who worked on the topic, also during the shut up and calculate time. One of the most important ones that we'll come back and discuss in detail is definitely Bell, John Bell, who developed these famous inequalities that we will discuss. So I think it's a very beautiful example of theory, because you just don't falsify one single theory, but a class of theories at once. And this is something testable experimentally. So there are experimental tests which show that these Bell inequalities are not fulfilled, and that means that you cannot have local realism. So there is no local theory which can describe the data as we see, as we measure. The details of all this will come later on. There are also other people who definitely contribute. For instance, Dieter Tse from Heidelberg, who in some of the time also was pretty left alone in his work about decoherence mostly, which is now an accepted feature of quantum mechanics, by the way. It is, no one doubts that decoherence is correct. So this is definitely a part of quantum mechanics. Actually, decoherence is what also causes many problems, because then we cannot see quantum superposition of big bodies. And this is the problem for quantum computing, is exactly the fact that decoherence prevents the superposition of states for a long time. How it prevents it, then, is a question of details that will go on. So let's go back. So there were surely people who still worked, but I would say that in the last 15 years, this went back. Also 20 years, even, this went back. Let me also mention one of the people persons who work on this topic, also in the time where no one worked. This was Ghirardi, an Italian physicist who died just 2 months ago and who developed one of the first theories in which the collapse of the wave function is a physical phenomenon. So it's not something metaphysical or whatever, it's really a physical process. And this is was one of the first models in that direction. And now one tries to do experimental tests to see if this is true or not, and in which sense. Okay. All these things, so let's see how we go on. I first do, so to say, a kind of presentation of some of the topics. And then today also a review of some quantum mechanicals. Of some quantum mechanical issues with by concentrating on the usual interpretation also, so with the standard. And actually, I would say that the standard interpretation, what we see in the course, is rather receipt, what to do, how to do the calculations. It is not very much what all Bohr has written down. We say that we use the Copenhagen interpretation developed by Bohr, but this is partly true. Actually, what we do is a receipt to apply calculations, calculate probabilities and calculate. This is, so to say, part of all what Bohr and Heisenberg have done. And there is much more about some sentences that, honestly, when I read them, I can hardly understand them that Bohr has written. Okay. So interpretation of quantum mechanics. There is some peculiarity when we look at the standard interpretation. And the first one is, let me say in the following sense, what is big and what is small? What is macroscopic, let's use a more scientific word, such a detector, and what is microscopic? So, of course, microscopic, we can put an electron. But can we put molecules? Most probably, yes. But where do we stop? So, molecules and so on. But also, what it is microscopic, of course, we can take detector, we can take a cat. But if we go down, what if we take, for instance, some microcellular organism and so on? So, where do we stop in the list? And is there something in between? So this question is crucial because in the, so to say, standard interpretation of quantum mechanics, we have big objects which do the measurement and small objects which are quantum. And there is a difference between these two because the big objects are classical. The big objects, detectors, follow classical rules. But no one tells us where is the limit. So where is the, is there a kind of, border or not, and this is absolutely left open, and this is one of the most dramatic drawbacks of the standard interpretation of quantum mechanics, that we have a division between small and big, but there is no way to define what is small and what is big. Then, of course, so this is, let's say, one question. The second question, say, this is just standard approach, some issues. The second point is that we have a linear evolution of the Schrödinger equation. But at the same time, it is like that we do not know if this linearity holds. It is some, let's say, absolutely valid property of quantum mechanics, as it is the Schrödinger equation, yes, this is linear. But the question if there could be some extensions which are non-linear, first point. And second, this linear evolution of the Schrödinger equation should be compared to the non-linear evolution of the measurement. So measurement is a collapse. So it happens all at a sudden. You have a change of the state from at the time just before the measurement to the time just after the measurement. And of course, in that sense, there was also some speculation if there is a certain role of the observer. And this, I think, from my personal point of view, no. I mean, there cannot be a difference between a person, another person, or a robot, or a detector, and so on. So there cannot be that the mind, in some sense, plays a special role. But I would say that there are some people who thought that. who really put forward the fact that the mind plays a special role. So the measurement didn't only finishes when there is someone, some person, but then how to define in this sense. Of course, to my opinion, it is clear that the detector is absolutely enough. You don't need to be in the room in which the detector works. The detector already does the job alone. So these things are some of the questions that already plug the beginning, some of them, because there are much more. I would say, in order to clarify better, I make an example. An example of concerning with decays and concerning with the famous cat, just to set up a bit some of the properties. So if we take one neutron decay, so the neutron we know that actually transforms into a proton, and of course there is also some electron and an antineutrino, but this is not important. So what is important for us is basically a neutron transforms into a proton. Then there are two particles which fly out. This is something that doesn't really, is not important for us. Now the question is that what we can say from quantum mechanics is only the probability that the neutron is still there after a certain time t. So suppose that at time t equals zero, we have a neutron. And then we ask, which is the probability to still have the neutron after a certain time t? And this probability is given by e minus t divided tau. And this tau is the mean lifetime. By the way, for the neutron, we have something like 10 minutes. Actually, to be precise, the half lifetime is 10 minutes, so there is the p t 1 half equal 1 half, and the mathematical relation is t 1 half equal, where is it? I forgot it. Tau log 2. And this is something like 10 minutes. So actually, tau is then something like 14 minutes. By the way, just a side remark, something that it is so well known, like the decay of the neutron, there are still some discrepancies in the lifetime of the neutron, which are up to now not understood. So depending on what you measure, if you measure how many neutrons stayed, or if you measure how many protons came out, you get a different lifetime. And there is up to, let's say, 4 sigma deviation. But one should be careful because of the detector techniques that one uses in one and the other case. It can be just that it is some artifacts due to the, or some systematic errors due to the detection. But it is still an unsolved problem of modern, of modern physics. And there are some people who link that to the fact that the neutrons can decay into some unseen particle, like some dark matter candidates, for instance. And when the neutron decays in something else that is not a proton, if you try to see the proton, you don't see them. So you get a different lifetime according to if you look at the neutron or if you look at the protons. And this is still not settled. I would say most probably it is a systematic problem of the experiments. Still, it is interesting to know that even something so basic and so fundamental like the decay of the neutron, there are still some features that are not understood, which is the lifetime. So there is a difference of 5 seconds, by the way. There are some nice review on the topic. If one is interested, I can give them. So, but let me go back to quantum mechanics. So at t equals zero, our state s t equals zero is equal neutron. N stands for neutron. For t to infinity, this is pretty easy. S, the state S for t going to infinity is the proton. I say that I don't consider electron and neutron. Of course, I should. The whole state would be proton, electron, neutrino. I just take neutron, proton. And if you are, let's say, at t equal t half time, then the state apart some phase can be written as a superposition of proton and neutron. So square, let's say, I'm forgetting a phase, it's a square root of 1, 2, square root of 1, 2. Now, standard quantum mechanics tell us which is the probability to have a proton on a neutron at this time. You just take this number modulus squared, and you have it. So 1/2, you have a proton. With probability 1/2, you have a neutron. Of course, this is valid. You can also take some different time. You need to take some generic time t. One would have something of the type e minus t divided 2 tau neutron plus something like square root 1 minus t divided 2 tau proton. Then you square, and the probability to have a neutron is still this one, the survival probability of the state. But according to QM, at least before we do the measurement, we have a superposition of this type. And then, so one does the measurement, let's say here, at this time we do a measurement. So at time t 1/2 we have this, and then at time t equal t 1/2 plus, so just a bit after the measurement, we get with probability 0.5 in that particular case, the state is only proton, only, and with probability 0.5 is only neutron. So, and it has collapsed. From this, it goes to either this or this. And this, so this number basically becomes 1 and this becomes 0, or vice versa, with the probability given by the state before the measurement. This is what we have usually. So this is quantum mechanics. And of course, before the measurement, we cannot say what it will come out. We can only give this kind of probability. So this looks rather peculiar, and it looks rather peculiar even to the beginning of quantum mechanics, also to Schrödinger. And of course, I have to start with the cat, because this had a very important, let's say, was an important point in the discussion of all quantum mechanics. By the way, it is like that. I will come back to this point. Schrödinger, when he put out his wave equation, actually, his idea was to have really waves. He didn't want to have any probability wave of something like that. His idea was wave, moving wave. And a particle would be a wave packet. The problem is that it doesn't work. As we will see exactly on the interference experiment, you don't see a wave pattern when you do the measurement. You see one point. So his idea, the ontology that Schrödinger wanted to have in his original writing of the Schrödinger equation was to have waves. But that didn't work because the experiment didn't work like that. But he realized that the Schrödinger equation was then reinterpreted not as a wave, as a wave matter wave, but it was reinterpreted as a probability wave. By the way, this was, of course, done by Max Born. And it is interesting that in his original paper, where he write that, first he says that the probability is given by the wave function. And then he writes, no, this cannot be, because the wave function can be positive or negative. Then there is a correction, a footnote, where he says this is the wave function squared. Then he realized, shit, but this can be a complex number. And then there is correction, a second note, there is the modulus squared. So this also shows that sometimes one goes by trial. So the psi squared, modulus psi squared. And this was then the final correct answer for the probability. But okay, let me go back maybe here to the Schrödinger cat, which we can link, of course, to our neutron proton measurement. So we have our usual box with the cat. And here we have our state with a neutron or a proton, let's say, neutron state. And then we have a detector. that measure if we have a neutron on a proton. And then we have some usual mechanism linked, so a kind of hammer with a poison here. And by the way, it seems that really Schrödinger didn't like cat in his when he put down this. So this was really linked to this. Of course, this is only a Gedanken experiment, so it was, to my knowledge, never done. But still, the fact that this cat, now there are in various, when one tries to put, to write some, or to generate, even experimentally, some quantum states, which are big, which are not small, even mesoscopic, one called them cat states. So a cat state, because it's a kind of, let's say, in direction being macroscopic state in quantum superposition. But okay, let me then go back to this. And let's say if the state, if the detector finds the neutron, so didn't decay, then nothing. The cat is left alive. When the detector measures the neutron, the proton, so the original particle has decayed, then the hammer destroys the poison, which kills the cat. Then the full system, the quantum state for the full system, is given by something like, let's say we do the measurement at T1/2. For simplicity, of course, we could take anything. This is neutron, and then I have Katzelbändig. I follow here. Cat alive. So a living cat plus proton, and the cat is dead. Katzetot. So, and we see here an entanglement of the state of the neutron with the state of the cat. But if the cat is made of atoms and so on, why not? So this is actually what quantum mechanics tells. Unless you say that the cat is a detector, which then makes it collapse. But then there is nothing, you cannot avoid to reach this conclusion, to have something like this. So this is just the linearity of the Schrödinger equation brings you to this quantum state after the measurement. I mean, we didn't do any measurement because we didn't collapse yet. So this is just the state when this process takes into account. We still didn't make the collapse. Of course, if you do the collapse, we will say 50%. We see the neutron and the cat is alive with 50%, this number modulus squared. We see the proton and the cat is dead. But if we don't yet, the system collapse yet, we just see how it evolves, then this is what we have. And of course the question is what then can cause the collapse? Actually, shouldn't a cat be enough to do that? Actually, I think yes, in this sense, the cat would be also a good detector. But this kind of example shows how difficult, so quantum mechanics is, because it doesn't tell what it is small, what it is large, but then if you apply quantum mechanics even to large objects, we find something of this type. By the way, there is a link to that. I didn't prepare it today, but it came now to my mind. You remember, surely you have read at a certain point there is a famous dispute between Einstein and Bohr. One of these things was that Einstein developed a kind of device in order to measure when you have a double slit, through which hole, through which slit, the particle has gone. And Bohr refuted this idea, this Gedanken experiment, by showing that even this double slit with attached some weight in order to measure through which hole the particle went through, also this big object has to be considered in the framework of quantum mechanics. But then, one always says, okay, Bohr has won. But this is not fully true, because in order to show this, you have to admit that even a big body is in a quantum superposition. Even this big double slit is now also in itself in a superposition. So in a sense, he also showed that his original idea, small bodies are quantum, big bodies are classical, this is not correct. And this, I mean, we see it also here with the cat. So now, again, if you use the shut up and calculate. You don't do something like that. You just stop there. You calculate your probability and you are over. You are here and you finish. But if you go further and you really would like to know what is going on, you should try to make sense of this expression. And so which are the possible solutions or things that were discussed and which we will go in the following, so in this course, so to say. So this is just the first idea, some sketch. But I will do it not only with words, also with equations. So I would like really to concentrate also on some calculations, not only some discussions. So also, I think it is sometimes important also to go to the formalism and see how these things then match to each other. So one of the solutions, the first one, is simply to admit, okay, quantum mechanics is not complete. There are some hidden variables. Some extra variables which tells us if the cat is alive or the cat is dead. It's simply that quantum mechanics doesn't tell us, so actually the description is correct but not complete. So the cat is not complete. Does not offer a complete knowledge of the system. And you may say, okay, but maybe someone has already heard that hidden variables are ruled out. This is not true. This is not true. There are examples, actually one which is the so-called Bohmian mechanics is a very nice example of a hidden variable approach which fulfills all the constraints of quantum mechanics. And there are trajectories, really trajectories. So this is done with trajectories. And it was, historically, I would say the first that came out. This is also why we'll discuss the first, also to follow a bit the historical development. It is also called the Broglie-Bohm approach. And it is, in that case, you really have that each particle follows exactly one trajectory. So you either have only the neutron or only the proton. The cat is only alive or only dead. There is no superposition of this type. This is just ignorance, like thermodynamics, that we do not know when you say that you have a certain temperature, you do not know which microsystem you have. You just have a limited knowledge of your system. The system has some microstate that you do not know. And the same would be true here. But there are some subtleties that we will discuss later on. What it is interesting is that it is deterministic, perfectly deterministic. So there is nothing like, so the probabilities are again a probability due to our ignorance on the system. But there are not some intrinsic probabilities. And I already mentioned these Bell inequalities. This kind of approach, this Bohmian mechanics, is in agreement with these Bell inequalities. How can it do it? Because it is non-local. I say these Bell inequalities kill all local realistic theories. But Bohmian mechanics, being non-local, is absolutely in agreement with the Bell inequalities. We'll come back then to the definition, and I will do these Bell inequalities rather in detail. But this is just so to say, the first one, there are some hidden variables. But of course, as I said, it cannot be local in a sense. The second is the many worlds. Also called Everett theory, later on developed by Actually, the name many words comes from Brice de Witt. That, by the way, is together with John Weller, is one. He started quantum gravity. He started quantum gravity. One, the canonical equation of quantum gravity. So the Weller de Witt equation comes exactly from him. And Everett used the name of relative state formulation. Actually, the same mathematics, the same stuff, simply that it was not so fancy. So the marketing name, many words, was much more, so to say, appealing and catchy. And this is how it stayed. So in that sense, it means that actually both of them are true. And they coexist. Then you have one world in which the cat is happy and one the cat is alive and happy, most probably, and the other in which the cat is dead. And they coexist in the same place. So, and you have both of them. So this is the idea of the idea of Everett is very simple. You just say, don't forget about the collapse. There is no collapse. This is all. So this is the question is how you make sense of the probabilities. And this is the key of the discussion is that. This will come back to this point later on, because why these numbers that are in front of the cat should correspond to the subjective probability to see that. And this is very subtle. But if we put the observer into the game, the full system with observer now, then you have square root 1/2, neutron, the cat is alive, observer most probably happy, plus square root 1/2, proton, the cat is dead, and the observer is most probably sad. And you have both of them, so there is a splitting of the two words, but it's not a splitting in space. They are exactly here. I mean, then of course, you can have also a splitting in space, because if the observer is happy, can decide to go out of the room and go to buy some food cat, while the other, if he's sad, he can stay here. So then, of course, the wave function, there is one wave function which goes out, but they are still there, but they are still on the same space here. So all the variety of all these words would be, are not in some other universe or so on. This, the many words of quantum mechanics is a splitting of the wave function. It's not in space. They are all here. The question is, why don't you experience them? This is the coherence. But this is also come. That basically all these branches, so let's say all the world would be the universe, this is world one, world two, they live then independently from each other. So you cannot have interference between these two after a very short time, so to say. And this is why the coherence is so important. Actually, the coherence is very good for these many words interpretation. It explains why you don't see these words around there. Okay, so this is... Yes?
Yeah, I have a short question concerning the second or the hidden variable.
Yes? Yeah, with quantum field theory, there's a big problem. Yeah.
So there is no version of Bohmian mechanics?
No, there are some attempts, but there is no agreement. While Bohmian mechanics, when you take non-relativistic quantum mechanics, everyone agrees that it works, that it is consistent. This is not true when you go to QFT. When you go to quantum field theory, the situation becomes more difficult. And the reason is that, so in the case of quantum mechanics and the Bohmian approach to quantum mechanics is that what it exists are the positions of the particles. But positions, when you go to quantum field theory, becomes fields. So then what it exists should be fields, but it doesn't really quite work. So that doesn't quite work the same way.
Okay, but why should I then consider Bohmian mechanics? Because the best theory we have on Earth is relativistic quantum electrodynamics, which then somehow rules out this.
Not really. No, let's say you cannot fully rule out, because as I said, there are some attempts to have some relativistic versions of QFT which follow the idea of Bohm. And one of them was even developed by John Bell himself. It's simply that there is no agreement that we still do not know if this is possible or not, let's put it this way. So it's not that it is ruled out that you cannot have this, but surely it is a knowledge that it is tricky. It is tricky to have something like that, yes. While for many words it is somehow easier, because you still have a quantum superposition also for even when you go to quantum field theory. So actually, if I go to QFT, the Everett approach is rather better. I mean, it comes automatically. This is maybe the reason why some people, or even so in particle physics and so on, they rather like this. By the way, if we think about this many words approach and the path integral formulation work by Feynman, we see many similarities, because the Feynman approach, a path going from one point to the other, can take any path at the same time. So this is kind of many words, if you want. By the way, both Feynman and Everett were students of John Wheeler, but they didn't speak with each other. So they came to something which is, in a sense, similar. But let's say, of course, what Feynman did with his path integral approach was even more important, because it's a method that we can use to QFT and so on. But, well, of course, they were influenced by the same supervisor, let's put it this way. So maybe it is no wonder that somehow they were working in topics that are not so far away. Okay, but we will come back also to this question when we go to these equations of Bohm to see how it becomes, how it works, then also to this QFT problematic. I mean, nowadays, quite many physicists agree with this, accept this. So, hey, this is, it is somehow, it looks crazy at first sight, but it is consistent. Why then we shouldn't accept this? We remove the collapse, and we just have a superposition of things. That's it. Then one accepts the many words, and the situation is over. It's not really true for this question it is crucial. Why this number here squared should be the probability that the observer thinks to see the cat alive? Why this number in front? I mean, as long as I have two words, okay, it is easy to think it is 50-50. But take another time where this is some number and this is another number. Why this number here, maybe, let's say, square root of 1/3, 33%, should be the probability that this observer gives to see the cat alive, and this number here, which would then be square root of 2/3 numbers squared, 66.6%, should be that probability. So why these numbers convert into probability for the observer, subjective probability? This is very difficult to understand. But there are some attempts to that. Okay. Let me then mention solution 3, which is GRV, let's say GRV theories, but actually theories with spontaneous collapse. So this is Girardi, Rimini, Weber, but there are also others that then came later, in which the collapse is a physical phenomenon. And then basically it says that the proton, the neutron and the proton, can be in a superposition. So you can have something of this. This is okay. But when you try to put the cat into superposition, it is unstable, and it either goes to one or to the other. So this, and so you don't need the observer or anything like that. This, it doesn't go. It decays either to or to proton and cat dead. So it goes either to the one or to the other. How does this happen? There are different ideas. This is, I would say, not complete approach, because we still don't know if this is true and so on. But it means that basically for microscopic objects, you may have superpositions, but then there is a limit when you go, when you consider bigger and bigger particles. And if the object is too large, the superposition is not anymore stable. So you cannot have a superposition of places. I mean, we have kind of big quantum objects like Bose-Einstein condensation, but this isn't the same place. But if you try to put a superposition of different places, different locations, then this is unstable. It goes either to one or to the other. And so this is done in an effective way by so-called GRV, but it is also done, for instance, Penrose and Diozzi, they linked this instability of such a superposition when big bodies, so the cat here, are included, to gravity. They say that gravity is the key and should be taken into account, and when you do that, actually such an object is not anymore stable. And it decays, I mean, one or to the other. And actually you also do not know how, because quantum gravity, no one has the theory. But so they even come out with a formula for the collapse time that we'll discuss then in some, I do not know when I will arrive to that, but definitely I will. So let's also put then. Penrose Diozzi. He's from, but Penrose I think everyone knows, and Diozzi I think is from Budapest, from Hungary. Okay, so these are, by the way, these are only three of, let's say, big classes. Between the many words, there are also consistent histories and other different sub-interpretations, hidden variables as well, and also with this kind of collapse theories, also a variety. So these are just three different classes of possible interpretation solutions. But let's say that while these two, they still have the Schrödinger equation exactly working, and actually against the first impression, these hidden variables and the many words are much more similar than they look. Actually, they are drastically different, because in one case you have trajectories, in the second case you have superpositions. But when one looks into the details, actually there are many similarities among these two. And the Schrödinger equation is exact in both of them, so they still work. Here, no. Here, the Schrödinger equation, there are some deviations from the Schrödinger equation. So this is a different theory than quantum mechanics. It has so this is, so to say, there are some deviations that can be measured experimentally. There are some experiments on that, one from some months ago, 1 year ago. We will discuss them later. Okay. This we have seen. Let's see what time we have. No, we can continue a bit, then we can do a break a bit later. And so what I would like to do now, so this was, so to say, the presentation of the, do you have some question about this? By the way, I have a question if you have ever heard about, for instance, this Everett. I mean, so this is, but definitely not in the quantum mechanics lectures. By the way, Everett left science because his ideas were not really, at the beginning they were completely ignored in the 50s. He then considered to come back to science because, I mean, De Witt was so good in popularizing this many words approach. But in the meantime, actually he was so successful in other things, he also became very rich. And then he decided not to come back. And he died pretty early, mainly also due to the fact that he was a heavily chain smoker. And it is still, De Witt and Wehler were inviting Everett to give some presentations and talks about physics and so on, even after he left science. And they did something that here was done for the old Bundeskanzler, they allowed him to smoke everywhere. So even in places where there was no, but this was still in the 80s, so it was still a different time, but they allowed to smoke even when he was giving this presentation. Okay, now what I would like to do is some recall of QM with some couple of, let's say, clarifications. Of course, we will not go over the derivations because, recall. Well, time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Let's write it again. This is for a single particle with mass m, under the influence of a potential V of R, and of course, Psi is a function of T and R. And it is a from R3 to complex numbers. So this is, it involves complex numbers, this we all know, and it is perfectly deterministic. If you know the initial the initial function, let's say you know that psi t equals 0 r is some function f of r, so the beginning you know where you start from, then is fixed, the wave function is fixed for each time, in the past and in the future, doesn't matter. So this is, so here at the level of the Schrodinger equation, there is nothing like indeterminacy and probabilities, nothing like that. It is a wave equation, which is a peculiarity. I think it's very interesting that there is an I. I think it's very, that there are complex numbers directly into it. You cannot do really quantum mechanics without complex numbers. You could do optics without quantum, without complex numbers. We use them because it is easier to work with them, but we could actually use only real objects. But, I mean, this is perfectly fine, and so on, and as I said before, I mean, this is what Schrödinger had in mind at the beginning. And it comes that it is not a wave, a matter wave, so it is not a wave of matter or something like that. It is a probability. So psi t r squared d3 r is the infinitesimal probability to find the particle in the volume d, d3r centered at r if a measurement is done at the time t. Measurement is done at t. So this is how it is, yeah? This is what it is. Of course, in order that this probability interpretation is correct, you must have that the integral over all the space must be 1 for each time t. So you need a continuity equation which guarantees this. And this is what the Schrödinger equation has. So there is a continuity equation. It guarantees us that if we start with some f of r for which this is valid, this will be valid at each time t, in the past, in the future, doesn't matter. So the probability is always 1. Of course, this we don't have decay here. We just have, let's say, one electron that moves. And there is no problem of this type, as long as we have a continuity equation, of course. And this is what one has. And this continuity equation just is something like the rho dt divergence j is equal to 0. And rho is psi tr squared. And it guarantees that this is a constant of motion. I don't do the derivation here, you know it already. So everything is absolutely, so to say, fine at this level. The situation is, so to say, different when we do a measurement. Now, suppose that, what does it mean to do a measurement in this respect? Suppose that I take it only with one dimension. At a certain time, t0, you have this wave function here. Let's say, let's take already squared. So the area is 1. And suppose to have a detector and find that the particle is somewhere, so the detector looks for the particle, let's say everywhere, and it finds that it is here with a certain error. How is the wave function after the measurement? So this is a t equal, let's say, t0 minus is the wave function, then we do the measurement. At t equal t0 plus, this piece, let's say, survives. Let's suppose that this detector doesn't destroy the wave function in the place where it finds. Somewhere here, x psi squared. So this piece goes up in such a way that the area is still 1. So it goes down like this. And this becomes 0 and 0. And if we call this position as x0, is the solution, the outcome of the measurement will be x0 plus minus some delta x, and delta x is given by this. So this is what a measurement does. So, and we also have the collapse here, the collapse on the position measurement. So we start from here, and then this piece is copied here, but it goes up because we have to fulfill the normalization. And this is our wave function after the measurement, which then will further evolve. Probably it will very fast diffuse on both directions, because actually the smaller delta x, the faster it will. Because, well, if you know the, basically you know here the position, you do not know where, then it will move very fast away. These are typical properties of Fourier transform. So, of course, this is something definitely not trivial. This is the nonlinear dynamics. So this is nonlinear, right? This point is perfectly linear. This evolution through the Schrödinger equation is perfectly linear. The nonlinearity is when you do a measurement of the position and you get this. Right? Okay, this is extremely, so to say, non-trivial, what it is happening from here. This is what we don't understand. Of course, apart from the possible solutions that I said before. This is, if we lose the look at the position, I just do another example. Yes? The collapse is instantaneous. The collapse is instantaneous. There is no time in there. It happens at exactly one.
Yeah, but why are we talking then about a non-linear evolution? Because there is no evolution.
If you want, you can avoid evolution. It is okay. Let's say in a instantaneous change of course. Then the question is, do we have indeed, is this wrong, so to say? It is a kind of effective description of some process. And then we go to what we were saying before. Of course, then this change would not be, would not take place at a time, with zero time. It can be a process. Yes, but then it is different. But we do not know absolutely how this would take place. So we do not know if there is a process that shows that. But even if you take the Everett interpretation, so the many words, then this doesn't happen instantaneously. So this goes to one word, the word in which the detector sees that. So it gets entangled with the detector. And this takes some time, which is very short, but this takes some time. But we will see indeed a moment in a model in which we will see this time going, and this is related to the coherence. So when we relate it to the coherence, then we can see something of this type and we can follow the time. So, but for the coherence, really, we still do not need to use the collapse, because the coherence would be valid even without collapse or whatsoever. This is really a feature of quantum mechanics when you have many particles. But then you can see some of these of the things. Yeah, I mean, the name nonlinear evolution is, so to say, misleading, because there is no evolution. It is a jump. It's nonlinear jump. It is a jump from one point, from t0 minus to t0 plus. But this is, according to me, of course, an effective description, a kind of practical receipt to do things. But it is hard to believe that nature works in this way. Still, we cannot exclude it at the moment. Okay. Let me, another thing that we usually do is a measurement of the energy. I just use it as an example. You can measure actually whatever you want, it doesn't matter. And suppose that then we have our Hamilton operator, and then we have some eigenfunction of the Hamilton operators with some energy value phi n. And then suppose that at the time t0, I can of course write my wave function as a sum of course, these coefficients will depend on the time t0 that we have taken, but this is definitely what we can do. And what does it mean? Now, considering that our wave function is normalized at every time, it means that the sum over all this n, cn squared, is 1. And what we do is, when we do a measurement of the energy, so this is our state at t equal t0 minus, and again, when we go to the time t equal to 0 plus, we find, for instance, that the energy is n1, and our new state will be phi n1 r, if you measure energy e1. Okay? And then after the measurement, you know which is exactly the wave function, and you know that the energy is exactly this one, E1. Of course, this is not related to the energy or whatsoever. This is related to the, this is just how a measurement works. Instead of using the positions, we use some discrete variables, but it is exactly the same. What it is interesting, then, the question why I chose the energy is just to discuss the following. Is energy conserved by this process or not? Actually, if we repeat the measurement different time, we find different energies. So the average of the energy of the state psi at the time t0 it's something like this. But it means that the energy is somehow not conserved, is conserved as an average, not in a sense, not for a single event. I mean, this object has a superposition of energies, and after the measurement, it gets only one. So somehow you broke the conservation of energy. But of course, when you do the sum, it's not true. I mean, everything is okay because the average of the energy will still be fine. And this is, of course, what we can measure. For instance, the average of E would be psi h psi at the time t0, of course. And then what one can measure is, so to say, the variance, which is square root in energy squared minus energy squared. And this is, there is something which is done pretty often. It is, I mean, of course, there's a Heisenberg indeterminacy relation. Is the following, that if you take two variables which do not commute, let's say two operators, A and B, for which A and B is different from zero, then one finds that delta A, delta B, where they are defined in the same way by taking the average over the corresponding operator, this is larger or equal 1/2 the average E, A, B. As a usual example, we put A equal position, B equal momentum, then you have delta X, delta P, larger h bar half. Of course, this is known. What I would like to do is now just to rediscuss this, I mean, more carefully, because there is something, I would say, interesting in this. So we usually say we cannot measure position and momentum at the same time, and when we know one, we know the other. But we should actually be a bit careful, because what does really mean this stuff? So what we should actually do is the following, is to imagine to prepare our quantum state many, many times, actually in the limit, it could be infinite, but doesn't matter, we can take, let's take 200 times. In 100, so we have our quantum state, our wave function, psi at a certain time t0 r, and we prepare it 200 times. In 100 cases, we measure the position. And we would find some instagram of this type. For the position measurement. So this would be actually the form of the wave, would be proportional to the form of the wave function squared at the time t0. So n, and this is x. This, what you see here, is the error of our measurement. And this is the variance. So what we actually here we have, this is the variance, is delta x. Note that the error of the measurement must be much smaller than the variance in order to see this instagram. Otherwise, you see nothing, right? So in 100% of the cases, we do this. And we find this distribution. Again, so the error is not the variance. These are different things. Actually, this should be much smaller than this in order to measure this. So we have such an instagram of this type. And then we could do the same. We could measure, instead of measuring x, so this is when you measure x, we could measure the momentum p. Then instead of psi t0r, we have to take a t0p, which is the Fourier transform. Of course, we take it squared. And then we have the probability distribution of the momentum. And then this object will have some momentum distribution. We will have a second instagram. This is the counting again. This will be proportional to a t0p squared. This is p, and we have a second instagram of this type. Again, the single measurement here on the 100 cases when we measure the momentum, this must be much smaller than the variance of the momentum, of course. And, so what actually the Heisenberg indeterminacy tells us has nothing to do with the error of the measurement. It tells about this large delta x and large delta p. So it is something different. It is, we say, 100 times we measure the position. We do our job. We find this delta x from the measurement. In 100 time cases, we can measure the momentum. We find the delta p, and they are related by this. But actually, the errors on the single measurement can be as small as we want. But either we measure x or we measure p. And when we measure x, we make the collapse along the so as I said before, the collapse of the wave function in the position, or if we measure p, we do a completely different collapse of the wave function. So in this sense, you cannot measure in this setup x and p at the same time, because either you measure x and you do the collapse along the x direction, either you measure p and then you make the collapse in that direction. But you cannot have both. Okay, then. There is still one, I have it here. Yes, one thing then we can do a small break is the following. It is true in this setup that I cannot measure x and p, these two quantities, the variances, are subject to the indeterminacy relation. So again, these Heisenberg relations are expressions that involve this here. It actually nothing to do with the error on the single measurements. Actually, that error should be much smaller in order to get this. But there is a nice example in which actually we can measure, let's say, kind of diffraction. We have here one electron with, let's say, one momentum P0. Here we have our screen. Let's call this axis y. And then, you know, the wave function of the electron will actually come like that. And we can measure the probability. It can basically be everywhere. The probability would be of position would be something like that. Okay? And we have here, we can make a measurement on the screen with some indeterminacy delta y. But originally, we knew the momentum. So actually, we can use the information that we have on the measurement, it is really the error of the measurement, this small delta, to infer also the momentum. So, because such a slit doesn't change the values of P0, just change the direction, but the length stays the same. Because there is no, I mean, this just changes the direction, but doesn't change the length. It's not an interaction which changes the momentum. So, if here we have the new P0, let's say, after that, this is Py, is the momentum along the y directions going up. And Py will be equal to P0 sinus theta. Right? And theta is the angle that we consider. Which, as usual, you take theta very small, the distance L very large. So this is actually P0 theta, and this is basically P0 y over L, where y is what we measure. But then it means that the error on the momentum is π0 delta y divided L. But we also measure the position as y. So if we do the error, the product of the error, delta py, delta y, this is p0 divided L, delta y squared. And this can be made as small as we want by taking L very large. So there is no indeterminacy here of the Heisenberg type for that. So one should be careful. So what this Heisenberg tells is really on this statistical ensemble by repeating many times, one measure x, one measure p, do the product. Here we have a simple example where actually we do a single measurement of position, and we infer both the position and also the momentum along the y direction, and this can be made as small as we want. So this is, I think, a very nice example that sometimes what we usually say, you may know the position, you don't know the moment. We should be really careful with this stuff in quantum mechanics. So what we really do is that. And there are some examples where you can easily, for what concerns really the errors, not these variances, really get something that is as small as desired, so to say. Okay, I think it is a nice moment to do, let's say, 15 minutes break. And then let's see, I still don't know, no, let's, we will continue later.